First-ranked midwives bustled around, preparing for unforeseen complications. On her gurney, Mohiyam looked entirely composed now, her thoughts turned inward, meditating. But Anirul noticed how old she appeared, as if the last shreds of youth had been drained from her. Arishka placed a sinewy hand on Anirul's forearm in a sudden and surprising display of closeness. "We all have our primal superstitions, but we must master them. For now, worry about nothing except this child. The sisterhood needs a healthy daughter, with a powerful future." Medical personnel checked equipment and took up their positions around Mohiyam, who reclined on a bed, inhaling deeply. Her cheeks flushed red with exertion. Two of the midwives propped her up in the ages-old delivery position. The pregnant woman began to hum to herself, allowing only a flicker of discomfort to cross her face as she experienced increasingly severe contractions. Standing aloof, yet sharply observant, Anirul considered what Mother Superior had just told her. Secretly, Anirul had consulted a feng shui master about the old birthing facility. A withered old man with Taurasian features, he was a practitioner of an ancient Zensuni philosophy which held that architecture, furniture placement, and maximum utilization of color and light all worked to promote the well-being of a facility's inhabitants. With a sage nod, he declared that the old facility had been set up incorrectly and showed Anirul what needed to be done. They'd had only a month before the expected delivery date, and the Kwisatz mother had had not a moment to lose. Now, as she observed the abundance of light flowing down upon Mohiyam's bed from actual windows and skylights, rather than from clusters of artificial glow globes, Anirul assured herself she hadn't been superstitious. Feng shui was about aligning oneself properly with nature and being intensely aware of one's surroundings, a philosophy that was ultimately very much in the Bene Gesserit way of thinking. Too much rode on this single birth. If there was a chance, even a small one, Anirul wanted no part in denying it. Using the power of her position, she had demanded a new birthing facility, built according to the feng shui master's recommendations. Then she'd sent the old man away, letting the other sisters believe he had merely been a visiting gardener. Now she glided closer to Mohiyam's bed, looking down at her patient as the time neared. Anirul hoped the old man was right. This daughter was their last, best chance. It happened quickly the moment Mohiyam set her mind to it. A baby's insistent crying filled the chamber, and Anirul lifted a perfect girl child in the air for Mother Superior to see. Even the voices in other memory cheered at the victory. Everyone beamed triumphantly, delighted with the long-anticipated birth. Agitated, the child kicked and flailed. Sisters toweled off infant and mother, giving Mohiyam a long drink of juice to restore her body fluids. Anirul handed the baby to her. Still breathing hard from the exertion of the delivery, Mohiyam took the girl and looked at her, allowing an uncharacteristically proud smile to cross her face. "This child shall be named Jessica, meaning wealth," Mohiyam announced proudly, still panting. When other sisters moved away, Mohiyam stared at Anirul and Harishka, who stood close to her. In a directed whisper that only they could hear, she said, "I know this child is part of the Kwisatz Haderach program. The voices in other memory have told me. I have seen a vision, and I know the terrible future if we fail with her." Anirul and Mother Superior exchanged uneasy glances. In a whisper, Harishka responded, looking sidelong as if hoping the spontaneous revelation might weaken the Kwisatz mother's hold over the program. "You are commanded to secrecy. Your child is to be the grandmother of the Kwisatz Haderach." "I suspected as much." Mohiyam sank back on her pillow to consider the immensity of this revelation. "So soon. Outside the building, clapping and cheering rang out as news of the birth passed quickly around the training areas. Balconies above the library enclaves and discussion chambers overflowed with acolytes and teachers celebrating the felicitous event, though only a handful knew the full significance of this child in the breeding program. Gaius Helen Mohiam gave the child to the midwives, refusing to form any sort of parental bond that was forbidden by the Bene Gesserit. Though she maintained her composure, she felt drawn, bone-weary, and old. This Jessica was her 10th daughter for the sisterhood, and she hoped her child-bearing duties were now at an end. She looked at young Reverend Mother Anirul Sado Tonkin. How could she do better than she had already done? Jessica, their future. I am indeed fortunate to participate in this moment, Anirul thought as she looked down at the exhausted new mother. It struck her as odd that of all the sisters who had worked toward this goal for thousands of years, of all those who now watched eagerly in other memory, she was the one to supervise the birth of Jessica. Anirul herself would guide this child through years of training toward the critically important sexual union she must have to carry the breeding program to its penultimate step. Wrapped in a blanket, the baby girl had finally stopped crying and lay peacefully in the sheltering warmth of its enclosed bed. Squinting down through the protective plaz, Anirul tried to imagine what this Jessica would look like as a grown woman. She envisioned the baby's face elongating and thinning, and could visualize a tall lady of great beauty, with the regal features of her father, Baron Harkonnen, generous lips and smooth skin. The Baron would never meet his daughter or know her name, for this would be one of the most closely guarded secrets of the Bene Gesserit. One day, when Jessica was of age, she would be commanded to bear a daughter, and that child must be introduced to the son of Abelard Harkonnen, the Baron's youngest demi-brother. At the moment, Abelard and his wife had only one son, Raban, but Anirul had set in motion a means of suggesting that they have more. This would improve the odds of one male surviving to maturity. It would also improve the gene selection and improve the odds of good sexual timing. A vast jigsaw puzzle remained apparent to Anirul, each of its pieces a separate event in the incredible Bene Gesserit breeding program. Only a few more components needed to slip into place now, and the Kwisatz Haderach would become a reality in flesh and blood. The all-powerful male who could bridge space and time, the ultimate tool to be wielded by the Bene Gesserit. Anirul wondered now, as she often had without daring to speak of it, if such a man could cause the Bene Gesserit to once again find genuine religious fervor, like the fanaticism of the crusading Butler family. What if he made others revere him as a god? Imagine that, she thought. The Bene Gesserit, who used religion only to manipulate others, ensnared by their own messianic leader. She doubted that could ever happen. Reverend Mother Anirul went out to celebrate with her sisters. The surest way to keep a secret is to make people believe they already know the answer. Ancient Freeman wisdom. "O Mekines, you have accomplished much," said one-eyed Hainar, as the two men sat on a rocky promontory above their siege. The Naib treated him as an equal now, even with overblown respect. Kynes had stopped bothering to argue with the desert people every time they called him Umma, their word for prophet. He and Hainar watched the coppery sunset spill across the sweeping June field of the great Erg. Far in the distance, a fuzzy haze hung on the horizon, the last remnants of a sandstorm that had passed the previous day. Powerful winds had washed the dunes clean, scrubbed their surfaces, recontoured the landscape. Kynes relaxed against the rough rock, sipping from a pungent cup of spice coffee. seeing her husband about to go above ground, outside the siege. A pregnant Freeth had hurried after the two men as they waited to bid the sun farewell for another day. An elaborate brass coffee service sat between them on a flat stone. Freeth had brought it, along with a selection of the crunchy sesame cakes Kynes loved so well. By the time he remembered to thank her for her kind attentiveness, Freeth had already vanished like a shadow back into the caves. After a long moment, Kynes nodded distractedly at the Naib's comment. "Yes, I've accomplished much, but I still have plenty to do." He thought of the remarkably complex plans required to complete his dream of a reborn Dune, a planetary name little known in the Imperium. Imperium. He rarely thought of the old Emperor now. His own priorities, the emphasis of his life, had changed so greatly. Kynes could never go back to being a mere Imperial planetologist, not after all he'd been through with these desert people. Hynar clasped his friend's wrist. "It is said that sunset is a time for reflection and assessment, my friend. Let us look to what we have done, rather than permit the empty gulf of the future to overwhelm us. You have been on this planet for only a little more than a year, yet already you have found a new tribe, a new wife." Hynar smiled. "And soon you will have a new child, a son, perhaps." Kynes returned the smile wistfully. Freeth was nearly through her gestation period. He was somewhat surprised that the pregnancy had happened at all, since he was gone so frequently. He still wasn't certain how to react to his impending role as a first-time father. He had never thought about it before. However, the birth would fit in neatly with the overall plan he had for this astounding planet. His child, growing up to lead the Freemen long after Kynes himself was gone, could help continue their efforts. The master plan was designed to take centuries. As a planetologist, he had to think in the long term, something the Freemen were not in the habit of doing, though, given their long troubled past, they should have been accustomed to it. The desert people had an oral history going back thousands of years, tales told in the siege describing their endless wanderings from planet to planet, a people enslaved and persecuted, until finally they had made a home here where no one else could bear to live. The Freeman way was a conservative one, little changed from generation to generation, and these people were not used to considering the broad scope of progress. Assuming their environment could not be adapted, they remained its prisoners, rather than its masters. Kynes hoped to change all that. He had mapped out his great plan, including rough timetables for plantings and the accumulation of water, milestones for each successive achievement. Hectare by hectare, Dune would be rescued from the wasteland. His Freeman teams were scouring the surface, taking core samples from the Great Bled, geological specimens from the Minor Erg and the Funeral Plain. But many terraforming factors still remained unknown variables. Pieces fell into place daily. When he expressed a desire for better maps of the planet's surface, he was astonished to learn that the Freeman already had detailed topographical charts, even climatic surveys. "Why is it that I couldn't get these before?" Kynes said. "I was the Imperial planetologist, and the maps I received from satellite cartography were woefully inaccurate." Old Hynar had smiled at him, squinting his one eye. "We pay a substantial bribe to the Spacing Guild to keep them from watching us too closely. The cost is high, but the Freemen are free, and the Harkonnens remain in the dark, along with the rest of the Imperium." Kynes was astonished at first, then simply pleased, to have much of the geographical information he needed. Immediately he dispatched traders to deal with smugglers and obtain genetically engineered seeds of vigorous desert plants. He had to design and build an entire ecosystem from scratch. In large council meetings, the freemen asked their new prophet what the next step might be, how long each process would take, when June would become green and lush. Kynes had tallied up his estimates and calmly looked down at the number. In the manner of a teacher answering a child who has asked an absurdly simple question, Kynes shrugged and told them, "It will take anywhere from 300 to 500 years, maybe a little more." Some of the freemen bit back groans of despair, while the rest listened stoically to the Umma, and then set about doing what he asked. 300 to 500 years. Long-term thinking, beyond their personal lifetimes. The freemen had to alter their ways. Seeing a vision from God, the would-be assassin Ulit had sacrificed himself for this man. From that moment on, the freeman had been fully convinced of Kynes's divine inspiration. He had only to point, and any freeman in the siege would do as he bid. The feeling of power might have been abused by any other person, but Pardat Kynes simply took it in stride and continued his work. He envisioned the future in terms of eons and worlds, not in terms of individuals or small plots of land. Now, as the sun vanished below the sands in a brassy symphony of color, Kynes drained the last drops of his spice coffee, then wiped a forearm across his sandy beard. Despite what Hynar had said, he found it difficult to reflect patiently on the past year. The demands of the labors for centuries to come seemed so much more significant, so much more demanding of his attention. "Hynar, how many freemen are there?" he asked, staring across the serene, open desert. He'd heard tales of many other sieges, had seen isolated freemen in the Harkonnen towns and villages, but they seemed like the ghosts of an endangered species. "How many in the whole world?" "Do you wish us to count our numbers, Umma Kynes?" Hynar asked, not in disbelief, simply clarifying an order. "I need to know your population if I'm to project our terraforming activities. I must understand just how many workers we have available." Hynar stood up. "It shall be done. We shall number our sieges and tally the people in them. I will send sand riders and distrans bats to all the communities, and we shall have an accounting for you soon." "Thank you." Kynes picked up his cup, but before he could gather the dishes himself, Freeth rushed out of the cave shadows. She must have been waiting there for them to finish, and gathered up the pieces of the coffee service. Her pregnancy hadn't slowed her down at all. "The first freeman census," Kynes thought. "A momentous occasion." Bright-eyed and eager, Stilgar came to Kynes's cavern quarters the next morning. "We are packing for your long journey, Umma Kynes. Far to the south. We have important things to show you." Since his recovery from the Harkonnen knife wound, Stilgar had become one of Kynes's most devoted followers. He seemed to draw status from his relationship with the planetologist, his brother-in-law. Stilgar served not for himself, though, but for the greater good of the freemen. "How long will the journey be?" Kynes inquired. "And where are we going?" The young man's grin sparkled, a broad display of white. "A surprise! This is something you must see, or you may not believe. Think of it as a gift from us to you." Curious, Kynes looked over at his work alcove. He would bring along his notes to document this journey. "But how long will it take?" 20 thumpers, Stilgar answered in the terminology of the deep desert, then called over his shoulder as he left. "Far to the south." Kynes's wife Freeth, now enormously pregnant, nevertheless spent long hours working the looms and the stillsuit repair benches. This morning Kynes finished his coffee and breakfasted at her side, though they spoke little to each other. Freeth simply watched him, and he felt he didn't understand a thing. Freeman women seemed to have their own separate world, their own place in the society of these desert dwellers, with no connection to the interaction Kynes had found elsewhere in the Imperium. It was said, though, that Fremen women were among the most vicious of fighters on the battlefield, and that if an enemy were left wounded and at the mercy of these ferocious women, he would be better served to kill himself outright. Then, too, there was the unanswered mystery of the Syedinas, the holy women of the Siege. Thus far, Kynes had seen only one of their number, dressed in a long black robe like that of a Bene Gesserit reverend mother. And no freeman seemed willing to tell him much about them. Different worlds, different mysteries. Someday Kynes thought it might be interesting to compile a sociological study of how different cultures reacted and adapted to extreme environments. He wondered what the harsh realities of a world could do to the natural instincts and traditional roles of the sexes. But he already had too much work to do. Besides, he was a planetologist, not a sociologist. Finishing his meal, Kynes leaned forward and kissed his Fremen wife. Smiling, he patted her rounded belly beneath her robes. "Stilgar says I must accompany him on a journey. I'll be back as soon as I can."
"How long?"
she inquired, thinking of the baby's impending birth. Apparently, Kynes, obsessed with his long view of events on this planet, had not noted his own child's expected due date and had forgotten to allow for it in his plans. 20 thumpers, he said, though he wasn't exactly certain how much distance that meant. Freeth raised her eyebrows in quiet surprise, then lowered her gaze and began to clean up their breakfast dishes.
"Even the longest journey may pass more quickly when the heart is content."
Her tone betrayed only the slightest disappointment.
"I shall await your return, my husband."
She hesitated, then said,
"Choose a good worm."
Kynes didn't know what she meant. Moments later, Stilgar and 18 other young freemen, decked out in full desert garb, led Kynes through the tortuous passages down and out of the barrier mountain and onto the enormous western sea of sands. Kynes felt a pang of worry. The parched expanse seemed too far and too dangerous. Now he was glad he wasn't alone. "We're going across the equator and below, Oma Kynes, to see where we freemen have other lands, our own secret projects. You shall see." Kynes' eyes widened. He had heard only grim and terrible stories about the uninhabitable southern regions. He stared into the forbidding distance as Stilgar rapidly checked over the planetologist's stillsuit, tightening fastenings and adjusting filters to his own satisfaction. "But how will we travel?" He knew the Siege had its own ornithopter, just a skimmer, actually, not nearly large enough to carry so many people. Stilgar looked at him with an expectant expression.
"We shall ride, Oma Kynes."
He nodded toward the youth who had long ago taken a wounded Stilgar back to the Siege in Kynes's ground car. "Amun will become a sand rider this day. It is a great event among our people."
"I'm sure it is," Kynes said. His curiosity piqued.
In their desert-stained robes, the freemen marched out across the sand, walking single file. Beneath the robes, they wore stillsuits, and on their feet, Temag desert boots. Their indigo blue eyes gazed out of the far past. One dark figure raced forward along a dune crest several hundred meters ahead of the rest of his group. Then he took a long, dark stake and shoved it into the sand, tinkering with controls until finally Kynes could hear the reverberating thump of repetitive pounding. Kynes had already seen such a thing during Glossu Rabban's ultimately frustrating worm hunt.
"He's trying to make a worm come?"
Stilgar nodded.
"If God wishes."
Kneeling on the sands, Amun removed a cloth-wrapped bundle of tools. These he sorted and laid out neatly. Long iron hooks, sharp goads, and coils of rope.
"Now what is he doing?"
Kynes asked. The thumper pounded its rhythm into the sand. The Freeman troop waited, carrying packs and supplies. Come, we must be ready for the arrival of Shai-Hulud, Stilgar said, nudging the planetologist to follow as they trudged into position on the sun-drenched dunes. The Freeman whispered among themselves. Presently, Kynes detected what he had experienced only once before, the unforgettable hissing, rushing roar of a sandworm's approach, as it was drawn inexorably to the throb of the thumper. On top of the dune, Amund crouched, grasping his hooks and goads. Long curls of rope hung at his waist. He remained perfectly motionless. His Freeman brethren waited on the crest of a nearby dune.
There! Do you see it? Stilgar said, hardly able to suppress his excitement.
He pointed off to the south, where the sand rippled as if a subterranean warship were heading straight for the thumper. Kynes didn't know what was going on. Did Amun intend to battle the great beast? Some sort of ceremony or sacrifice before their long journey across the desert?
Be ready, Stilgar said and grasped Kynes's arm. We will help you in every way we can.
Before the planetologist could ask another question, a roaring vortex of sand formed around the thumper. Alert and battle-ready, Amun skittered back, crouching down, ready to spring. Then the enormous mouth of the sandworm emerged from the depths and engulfed the thumper. The monster's broad-ringed back rose out of the desert. Amun sprinted, running with all his might to keep pace with the moving worm. But he wallowed in the loose sand. Then he sprang onto the arched, segmented back, using the hooks and claws to haul himself atop one of the worm segments.
Kynes stared in awe, unable to organize his thoughts or comprehend what the daring young man was doing. This can't be happening, he thought. It's not possible.
Amun dug one of his scoop-like hooks into the crevice between worm segments and then yanked hard, separating the well-protected rings and exposing pinkish flesh underneath. The worm rolled to keep its sensitive, exposed segment away from the abrasive sands. Amun scrambled up and planted another hook, spreading wide a second segment so that the worm was forced to rise higher out of its secret world beneath the desert. At the highest point on the worm's back, behind its huge head, the young Freeman planted a stake and dropped his long ropes so that they hung from the sides. Now he stood tall and proud on the worm, signaling for the others to come. Cheering, the Freeman ran forward, bringing Kynes with them. He stumbled to keep up. Three other young men scaled the ropes, adding more of what they called maker hooks to keep the worm above the dunes. The big creature began to move forward, but in a confused fashion, as if unable to understand why these bothersome creatures were goading it. As the Freeman kept pace, they tossed up supplies. Packs were lashed to the worm's back with more ropes. The first riders assembled a small structure as fast as they could. Prodded by Stilgar, an astonished Kynes ran up beside the towering worm. The planetologist could feel friction heat rising from beneath, and he tried to imagine what awesome chemical fires formed a furnace deep within the worm itself.
"Up you go, Amma Kynes!" Stilgar shouted, helping him place his feet into loops in the ropes.
Clumsily, Kynes scrambled up, his desert boots finding purchase on the worm's rough hide. He climbed and climbed. The simmering energy of Shai-Hulud caused him to lose his breath, but Stilgar helped him to the top where the other Freeman riders had gathered. They had assembled a crude platform and seat for him, a palanquin. The other Freeman stood holding their ropes against the enormous worm as if it were a bucking steed. Gratefully, Kynes took the proffered seat and held on to the arms. He had a disconcerting feeling up here, as if he didn't belong and could easily be toppled off and crushed to death. The rolling movement of the worm made his stomach lurch.
"Normally such seats are reserved for our Sayyadinas," Stilgar said. "But we know you do not have the training to ride Shai-Hulud, and so this shall be a place of honor for our prophet. There is no shame in it."
Kynes nodded distractedly and looked ahead. The other freemen congratulated Amun, who had successfully completed this important rite of passage. He was now a respected sandrider, a true man of the Siege. Amun pulled on the ropes and hooks, guiding the worm. Hi-yo! The huge, sinuous creature raced across the sands, heading south. Kynes rode all that day, with the dry, dusty wind blowing in his face and sunlight reflecting off the sands. He had no way of estimating the speed at which the worm cruised, but he knew it must be astonishing. As the hot breezes whipped around him, he could smell freshets of oxygen and the flinty, burned stone odors of the worm's passage. In the absence of extensive plant cover on Dune, the planetologist realized the worms themselves must generate much of the atmospheric oxygen. It was all Kynes could do to hold on to his palanquin. He had no way to access his notes and records in the pack on his back. What a magnificent report this would make! Though he knew in his heart he could never give such information to the Emperor. No one but the freemen knew this secret, and it must remain that way. We are actually riding a worm. He had other obligations now, new and far more important allegiances. Centuries earlier, the Imperium had placed biological testing stations at strategic points on the surface of Dune. But such facilities had fallen into disrepair. In recent months, Kynes had been reopening them, using a few Imperial troops assigned to the planet just to maintain appearances. For the most part, though, he staffed them with his own freemen. He was amazed at the ability of his Siege brothers to infiltrate the system, find things for themselves, and employ technology. They were a marvelously adaptable breed, and adapting was the only way to survive on a place like Dune. Under Kynes's direction, the freemen workers stripped equipment from the isolated biological stations, took necessary items back to their sieges, and filled out paperwork to report the pieces as lost or damaged. The oblivious Imperium then replaced the losses with new instruments so that the station monitors could continue their work. After hours of rapid travel across the Great Flat, the enormous worm became sluggish, exhibiting obvious fatigue, and Amun had difficulty exerting control. The worm showed signs of wanting to bury itself beneath the sand, increasingly willing to risk abrading its sensitive, exposed tissue. Finally, Amun brought the behemoth around until it ground to a halt, exhausted. The troop of desert men dropped off while Kynes slid down the rough worm segments onto loose sand. Amun tossed down the remaining packs and dismounted, letting the worm, too utterly tired to turn and attack them, wallow its way into the sands. The freemen removed the hooks so the worm, their Shai-Hulud, could recover. The men sprinted to a line of rock, where there would be caves and shelter, and, Kynes was surprised to see, a small siege that welcomed them for the night with food and conversation. Word of the planetologist's dream had spread to all the secret places across Dune, and the siege leader there told them it was his great honor to host Oma Kynes. The next day the group set off again on another sandworm, and another. Kynes soon gained a more complete understanding of what Stilgar had meant with his assessment of a 20-thumper journey. The wind was fresh, and the sand was bright, and the freemen took enormous pleasure in their grand adventure. Kynes sat atop his palanquin like an emperor himself, looking out over the desertscape. For him the dunes were endlessly fascinating, and yet strangely the same at so many latitudes. Near Hynar's Siege, a month earlier, Kynes had flown alone in his small Imperial ornithopter, exploring aimlessly. He had been blown off course by a small storm. He'd held control, even against the gusting winds, but he had been awestruck to look down upon the open sands where the storm had scoured clean a flat, white basin. A salt pan. Kynes had seen such things before, but never here on Dune. The geological formation looked like a white mirrored oval, marking the boundaries of what had once been an open sea thousands of years ago. By his estimate, the pan was 300 kilometers long. It thrilled him to imagine that in the past, this basin might have been a large inland ocean. Kynes had landed the thopter and stepped out in his stillsuit, ducking low and squinting into the blowing dust. He knelt and dug his fingers into the powdery white surface. He tasted his fingertip to confirm what he'd suspected. Bitter salt. Now he could have no doubt that there had once been open water on this world. But for some reason it had all disappeared. As successive sandworms took them below the equator and into the deep southern portion of the wasteland planet, Kynes saw many other such things to remind him of his discovery. Glinting depressions that might have been the remnants of ancient lakes, other open water. He mentioned these things to his Freeman guides, but they could explain them only by myths and legends that made no scientific sense. His fellow travelers seemed more intent on their destination. Finally, after exhausting and long days, they left the last worm behind. The Freeman pushed on into the rocky landscapes of the deep southern regions of Dune, near the Antarctic Circle where the great Shai-Hulud refused to travel. Though a few water merchants had explored the northern ice caps, the lower latitudes remained primarily uninhabited, avoided, shrouded in mystery. No one came here, except for these Freemen. Growing more and more excited, the troop walked for a day over gravelly ground, until finally Kynes saw what they had been so eager to show him. Here, the Freemen had created and tended a vast treasure. Not far from the diminutive polar ice cap in a region where he had been told the weather was too cold and inhospitable for habitation, the Freemen of various sieges had set up a secret camp. Following the length of a wash, they entered a rugged canyon. The floor was composed of stones rounded from long-ago running water. The air was chilly, but warmer than he had ever expected so deep in the Antarctic Circle. From a sheer cliff overhead, where ice and cold winds at the top gave way to warmer air in the depths, water actually trickled from cracks in the rock and ran seasonally along the length of the wash they had followed to get there. The Freeman teams had cleverly installed solar mirrors and magnifiers in the cliff walls to warm the air and melt frost from the ground. And there, in the rocky soil, they had nurtured plants. Kynes was speechless. It was his dream, before his very eyes. He wondered if the source could be water from hot springs, but upon touching it he found it to be cool. He tasted and found it not sulfurous but refreshing, easily the best he had drunk since coming to Dune. Pure water, not recycled a thousand times through filters and still suits. "Behold our secret, Amma Kynes," Stilgar said. "We have done all this in less than a year." Tufts of hardy grass grew in moist patches on the floor of the arroyo. Bright desert sunflowers, even the low creeping vines of a tough gourd plant. But most amazing of all, Kynes saw rows of stunted young date palms, clinging to life, sucking up the moisture that found its way through cracks in the porous rock and seeped up from a water table beneath the canyon floor. "Palm trees," he said. "You've already begun." "Yes, Amma," Stilgar nodded. "We can see a glimpse of Dune's future here. As you promised us, it can be done. Freemen from all across the world have already begun your tasks of scattering grasses on the downwind sides of the dunes to anchor them." Kynes beamed. So they had been listening to him after all. Those scattered grasses would spread out their webwork of roots, retaining water, stabilizing the dunes. With equipment stolen from the biological testing stations, the Freemen could continue their work of cutting catch basins, erecting wind stills, and finding other means to grasp every droplet of water borne on the wind. His group remained in the sheltered canyon for several days, and Kynes felt giddy with what he saw there. As they camped and slept and walked among the palmeries, freemen from other sieges came at intervals. This place seemed to be a new gathering point for the hidden people. Emissaries arrived to gaze with awe upon the palm trees and plants growing in the open air, upon the faint smear of moisture oozing from the rocks. One evening, a single sand rider came trudging in carrying his gear, looking for Ummah Kynes. Breathless, the newly arrived traveler lowered his eyes, as if he didn't want to meet the planetologist's gaze. "At your command, our numbering has been completed," he announced. "We have received word from all the sieges, and we now know how many freemen there are."
"Good," Kynes said, smiling. "I need an approximate number so I can plan for our work."
Then he waited expectantly. The young man looked up and stared at him directly with blue-in-blue eyes. "The sieges are counted in excess of 500. Kynes drew a quick breath, far more than he had suspected. "And the number of actual freemen on Dune is approximately 10 million. Would you like me to compile the exact numbers, Ummah Kynes?"
Kynes staggered back with a gasp. Incredible! The Imperial estimates and the Harkonnen reports had implied mere hundreds of thousands, 1 million at the very most.
10 million!
He hugged the astonished young freeman messenger. "So many willing workers. With such an army of laborers, we can indeed remake an entire planet."
The messenger beamed and stepped back, bowing at the honor the planetologist had shown him.
"And there is more news, Ummah Kynes," the man said. "I've been instructed to tell you that your wife Freeth has given birth to a strong young son who is sure to be the pride of his siege one day."
Kynes gasped and didn't know what to say. He was a father.
He looked at Amon and Stilgar and the members of his exploration team. The freemen raised their hands and shouted congratulations to him. He had not let it penetrate through his consciousness until now, but he felt a flood of pride washing over his surprise. Considering his personal blessing, Kynes looked at the palm trees, at the growing grasses and flowers, and then up at the narrow slice of blue sky framed by canyon walls. Freeth had given birth to a son.
"And now the freemen number 10,000,001, he said.
Hatred is as dangerous an emotion as love. The capacity for either one is the capacity for its opposite. Cautionary Instructions for the Sisterhood, Bene Gesserit Archives, Wallach 9. The two dim suns of the Quent'Sing binary system shone through the murky skies of Bella Tejus. The blood-red nearer sun imparted a purplish cast to the afternoon sky, while the ice-white primary, too distant to add much heat or light, hovered like an illuminated hole in the twilight heavens. A scrubby-surfaced and unappealing planet, it was not on any of the main Guild trans-space routes, and highliners didn't often stop here. In this dismal place, the lady supervised her above-ground gardens and tried to remind herself that this was her temporary home. Even after the better part of a year, she felt herself a stranger here. She stared into the cold gloom and across the agricultural fields at her hired local workers.